Mila asked. The woman who had been listening didn't wait to hear the answer. She had stopped for a moment, then, with a malicious smile, hurried away. Wolf ran ahead, stopping now and then to make sure the woman and man were still following him. The sloping path down from the northeast end of the front terrace led to a meadow on the right bank of a small river that was nearing its confluence with the main stream. The level grassy lea was surrounded by open, mixed woodland that grew more dense farther upstream. When they reached the meadow, Winnie whickered a greeting, and some people who were watching from a distance shook their heads in amazement when the wolf ran straight to the mare and they touched noses. Then the canine struck a playful pose with his tail and back end up and his front end down and yipped a puppy bark at the young stallion. Racer lifted his head in a neigh and pawed the ground, returning the playful gesture. The horses seemed particularly happy to see them. The mare approached and put her head across Ayla's shoulder, while the woman hugged the sturdy neck. They leaned against each other in a familiar posture of comfort and reassurance. Jondalar patted and stroked the young stallion, rubbing and scratching the itchy places Racer presented. The dark brown horse took a few paces forward, then nuzzled Ayla, wanting contact with her, too. Then they all crowded close together, including the wolf, welcoming each other's familiar presence in this place of so many strangers.
"I feel like going for a ride," Ayla said.
She looked up at the position of the sun in the afternoon sky.
"We have time for a short one, don't we?"
"We should have. No one will gather for the feast until it's almost dark." Jondalar smiled. "Let's go. We can swim afterward," he said. "I feel as though someone is watching me all the time."
"Someone is," Ayla said. "I know it's just natural curiosity, but it would be nice to get away for a while."
Several more people had gathered to watch from some distance. They saw the woman leap with ease onto the back of the dun-yellow mare, and the tall man seemed to do little more than step up to mount the brown stallion. They left at a fast pace, the wolf following along with ease. Jondalar led the way, first upstream a short distance to a shallow crossing of the tributary, then continuing upstream along the opposite bank of the small river a little farther, until they saw a gorge-like narrow valley on their right. They rode north, away from the stream, and up the length of the confined vale along a rocky, dry stream bed that became a runoff creek in wet weather. At the end of the gorge was a steep but climbable trail that eventually opened out onto a high, windy plateau that overlooked the waterways and countryside below. They stopped to take in the commanding view. At an elevation of some 650 feet, the plateau was one of the highest in the immediate area and afforded a breathtaking panorama, not only of the rivers and valley floodplains, but across to the landscape of rolling hills of the highlands on the other side. The limestone coasts above the river valleys were not level plateaus. Limestone is soluble in water, given enough time and the right acidic content. Over the long ages, rivers and accumulated groundwater had cut down through the limestone base of the region, carving the once flat floor of the ancient sea into hills and valleys. The existing rivers created the deepest valleys and the steepest cliffs, but though the stone walls that reared up and constrained the valleys often had a uniformity of height in any one section, they varied in elevation from place to place, following the pattern of hills above. At a cursory glance, the vegetation of the dry, windy, high coasts on both sides of the primary river all seemed the same, similar to the open plains of the continental steppes to the east. Grass was most prevalent, with stunted junipers, pines, and spruces clinging to exposed areas near streams and ponds, and brush and small trees growing in the dips and dells. But depending on where it grew, the plant life could be surprisingly different. The sparse tops and north-facing sides of the hills favored a more arctic herbage that flourished where it was cold and dry, while the south-facing slopes were greener and richer in lower-latitude boreal and temperate climate plants. The broad valley of the main river below was more lush, with deciduous trees and evergreens lining the banks. Showing a paler shade of green than they would later in the season, the freshly leafed-out trees were mostly the small-leaved varieties like silver birches and willows. But even conifers such as spruces and pines showed light-colored needles of new growth at the tips. The junipers and occasional evergreen oaks were more mottled with their spring color appearing at the ends of branches and twigs. At times along its course, the waterway meandered through the middle of verdant meadows in the level floodplains, with the tall grass of early summer turning to gold. In other places, the curves and loops of the river's course narrowed the stream and forced it to flow against the stone walls, closer to the cliffs on first one side and then the other. In places where the conditions were just right, the floodplains of some rivers, especially tributaries, supported small mixed forests. In protected areas, especially on south-facing slopes away from the wind, chestnut, walnut, hazelnut, and apple trees grew, many stunted and non-bearing in some years, but providing a welcome bounty in others. Along with the trees were a variety of fruit-bearing vines, bushes, and plants, including strawberries, raspberries, and currants, with some grapes, gooseberries, and blackberries, a few raspberry-like yellow cloudberries, and several varieties of round blueberries. At even higher elevations, fragile tundra vegetation prevailed, especially the high massif to the north, which was cloaked with glacial ice, though it brandished several active volcanoes. Ayla and Jandalar had found hot springs in the region when they traveled through it several days before they arrived. Lichens clung to rocks, herbs hovered only inches above the ground, and dwarfed shrubs lay prostrate across the frigid land over a base of permanently frozen subsoil. Mosses in variegated colors of green and gray softened the landscape in wetter regions, along with reeds, rushes, and certain grasses. The diversity of vegetation throughout the region made for a richness of variety and choice and encouraged a like richness of animal life. They continued along a trail that turned northeast across the elevated field to the edge of a steep cliff that overlooked the river, which was now flowing almost precisely from north to south as it washed against the wall of limestone below. On relatively level ground, the path crossed over a small stream, then took a northwestern turn. The creek continued to the edge and dropped down the face of the scarp. They drew to a halt when the trail began a gradual descent down the other side and turned back. On the way back, they urged the horses to a gallop and raced across the high open field until the animals slowed of their own accord. When they came to the small stream again, they stopped to let the horses water, along with Wolf, and got down to get a drink themselves. Ayla had not felt so wonderfully free riding the horse since she first climbed on the back of the mare. There were no encumbrances, no travois or traveling packs, not a saddle blanket or even a halter. Just her bare legs against the horse's back, the way she had originally learned to ride, transmitting signals to Winnie's sensitive skin, unconsciously at first, to guide the animal in the direction she wanted to go. Racer had a rope halter. It was the way Jandalar had trained the stallion, though he'd had to invent both the device to hold the stallion's head and the signals to tell the horse where he wanted to go. He also felt free in a way that he hadn't for a long time. It had been a long journey, and the responsibility of getting them home safely had weighed heavily on him. That weight was gone, along with his traveling packs, and riding the horse was nothing short of fun. They both felt exhilarated, excited, unaccountably pleased with themselves, and they showed it with their delighted smiles as they walked along the stream a few paces.
"That was a good idea, Ayla, going for a ride," Jandalar said, grinning at her.
"I think so, too," she said, smiling back the way that he always loved.
"Oh, woman, you are so beautiful," he said,
putting his arms around her waist and looking down at her with his intensely blue and vibrant eyes showing all his love and happiness. The only place she had ever seen a color to match his eyes was on top of a glacier in the deep wells of meltwater.
"You are beautiful, Jandalar," I know you say that men are not called beautiful, but you are to me, you know.
She put her arms around his neck, feeling the full force of the natural charisma that few could resist.
You can call me anything you want, he said, as he bent down to kiss her, and suddenly hoped it would not stop there.
They had grown accustomed to their privacy, to being alone in the middle of the open landscape, away from curious eyes. He was going to have to get used to being around so many people again, but not just now.
His tongue gently prodded her mouth open, then reached for the softness and warmth inside. She explored his in return, closing her eyes to let herself feel the sensations he was already beginning to arouse. He held her close, enjoying the feel of her body next to his. And soon, he was thinking, they would have the ceremony to join together and form a hearth to which he would bring her children, the children of his hearth, perhaps the children of his spirit. And if she was right, even more than that, they might even be his children, the children of his body, started with his essence, the same essence he could feel rising in him now. He pulled back and looked at her, then with more urgency kissed her neck, tasted the salt on her skin, and reached for her breast. It was fuller. He could feel the difference already. Soon it would be full of milk. He untied the belt around her waist, reached inside to hold the firm round weight, and felt the hard erect nipple in his palm. He lifted her top, and she helped him pull it off, and then she stepped out of her short pants. For a moment, he just looked at her standing in the sun and filled his eyes with the womanliness of her, the beauty of her smiling face, the firm muscularity of her body, the large, high breasts and proud nipples, the slight rounding of her stomach, the dark blonde hair of her mound. He loved her so much, wanted her so much. Tears came to his eyes. Quickly he unfastened his own clothing and laid them out on the grass. She took a few paces toward him, and when he stood up, she reached for him as he enfolded her in his arms. She closed her eyes as he kissed her mouth and her neck and throat, and when he filled his hands with her breasts, she filled hers with his rearing manhood. He dropped to his knees, tasting the salt of the skin of her neck and running his tongue from her throat to her cleavage, holding both breasts, and then, as she bent over slightly, he took a nipple in his mouth. She held her breath, feeling the jolt of excitement reach all the way to her place of pleasures inside, and another when he changed to the other nipple and suckled hard, while he massaged the first with his knowing fingers. Then he pressed her breasts together to get both in his mouth at once. She moaned and gave herself up to the sensations. He traced each hard, eager nipple again and dropped lower to her navel, then to her mound, flicked his warm tongue into her slit, and tickled the small knob within. Fierce sensations raced through her as she arched toward him, and a cry escaped her lips. With his arms wrapped around her rounded bottom, he pulled her toward him, pushing his tongue in and out of her slit over her hard nodule. Standing there, her hands on his arms, her breath coming in short, moaning gasps as she felt every warm stroke, she felt the tide rise inside her, pressing against her until suddenly it released with a spasm and another of delight. He felt the warmth and wetness and savored the taste that was distinctly Ayla. She opened her eyes and looked down at his mischievous smile. "You caught me by surprise," she said.
"I know,"
he said, grinning. "It's my turn now," she said with a laugh, giving him a little shove that toppled him over.
She covered him with herself and kissed him, noting the slight taste of herself. Then she nibbled his ear and kissed his neck and his throat, while he smiled with delight. He loved it when she had fun with him, and joined him in playfulness when they felt in that mood. She was kissing his chest and his nipples and running her tongue through his hair and to his navel, and then lower still until she found his full, ready member. He closed his eyes when he felt her warm mouth cover him, letting the feeling fill him as she moved up and down, creating suction along the way. He had taught her, as he had been taught, the ways to please each other. For a moment, He thought of Zelandani when she was young and known as Solina, remembering when he thought he'd never find a woman like her. But he had, and suddenly he was so overwhelmed, he sent a thought of gratitude to the great Earth Mother. What would he do if he ever lost Ayla? His mood suddenly changed. He had enjoyed being playful, but now he wanted the woman. He sat up, pulled her up on her knees to face him, and sat her on his lap with her legs on either side of him. He took her in his arms and kissed her with an intensity that surprised her, then held her tight. She didn't know what had changed his mood, but her love for him was as strong, and she responded in kind. Then he was kissing her shoulders and neck and caressing her breasts. She felt his need upon him so hard it almost raised her up. He was nuzzling her breasts, trying to find her nipples. She lifted up a bit, arched her back, and felt the sensations race through her as he suckled and nibbled. She felt his hard, fiery rod under her and raised up a little higher, and without thinking, she found herself guiding him into her. It was almost more than he could bear as she lowered herself on him, taking him into her warm, wet, eager embrace. She lifted again, leaned back while he held her close with one arm to keep one nipple in his mouth while he massaged her other one, as though he couldn't quite get enough of her womanness. She was guiding herself on him, feeling the pleasure fill her with every stroke, breathing hard and crying out. Suddenly the need was stronger upon him, building with each lift and plunge. He let go of her breasts, leaned back on his hands, and raised up, lowered, and raised again. Both cried out as waves of intense pleasure grew with each thrust, until with a glorious flood of shuddering release, they peaked in a culmination of delight. A few more strokes, and he lay back on the grass, felt a small stone under his shoulder, and ignored it. Ayla lay forward on top of him, her head resting on his chest, and stayed there for a while. Finally she sat up again. He smiled at her as she rose up and disengaged. He would have liked to stay close longer, but they did have to get back. She walked a few feet to the small stream and squatted down to rinse off. Jandalar rinsed off as well.
"We're going to be swimming and washing as soon as we get there," he said.
"I know. That's why I'm not being too careful."
For Ayla, cleansing herself, if it was at all possible, was a ritual taught to her by Issa, her clan mother, though the woman had wondered if her strange daughter, so tall and unattractive, would ever have reason to use it. Because Ayla was so meticulous about it, even using freezing icy streams, it had become a habit for Jandalar as well, though he hadn't always been so fastidious. When she went to get her clothes, Wolf approached her, head lowered and tail wagging. When he was young, she'd had to train him to stay away from them when they shared pleasures on their journey. It had annoyed Jandalar to have the wolf bother them, and she hadn't liked being interrupted either. When it wasn't enough to tell Wolf quite forcefully to go away when he came sniffing around to see what they were doing, Ayla had been required to tie a rope around his neck to keep him away, sometimes quite a distance away. Eventually he had learned, but he always approached her cautiously afterward, until she signaled him that it was all right. The horses, patiently grazing nearby, came at their whistles. They rode to the edge of the plateau and stopped again to look down at the valleys of the primary river and its tributary, and the complement of limestone cliffs that paralleled their courses. From the high field, they could see the confluence of the small river flowing from the northwest, and the main stream as it approached from the east. The smaller river flowed into the primary just before the larger river turned south, while it was still moving down a west-flowing section of its course. To the south, at the end of a series of cliffs, they saw the geologic block of limestone that contained the tremendous overhanging ledge of the ninth cave, with its long front terrace. But as Ayla looked down at the home of the ninth cave, it was not the remarkable size of its overhanging shelter that held her attention, but another most unusual formation. Long before, during a formative orogeny, a period of mountain building, when impressive peaks were folded and raised at the leisurely pace of geologic time,
A pillar of igneous rock broke away from the place of its volcanic birth and fell into a stream. The wall of stone from which the pillar had come had taken the shape of its crystal structure as fiery magma cooled into basalt, forming itself into great columns with flat sides meeting at angles. As the rock that broke loose was moved along, pushed by torrential floods and dragged by glacial ice, the columnar piece of basalt, though bashed and battered, retained its basic shape. The pillar of stone was eventually deposited on the floor of an inland sea, along with deep layers of accumulated sediments of marine life that were creating limestone. Later earth movements raised the sea floor, which eventually became a land of rounded hills and cliffs along river valleys. As water, weather, and wind eroded the great faces of vertical limestone into the shelters and caves used by the Zelandanyi, they also exposed the erratic, the battered piece of basalt from a distant location shaped like a column. As if its sheer size weren't enough to make the site unique, the huge debris was made even more unusual by the strange long stone embedded near the top and jutting out of the front of the huge limestone overhang. Though buried deeply into the cliff at one end, it was weathering out at such an angle that it seemed about to fall, making a distinctive landmark that added a striking element to the extraordinary rock shelter of the ninth cave. Ayla had seen it when she first arrived, and with a shiver of recognition, felt she had seen it before.
"Does that stone have a name?"
she asked, pointing to it.
"It's called the Falling Stone," Jondalar said.
"That's a good name for it," she said.
"And didn't your mother mention names for those rivers?"
"The main river doesn't really have a name," Jondalar said. "Everyone just calls it the river. Most people think of it as the most important river in the region, even though it's not the biggest. It flows into a much larger one south of here. In fact, we call that one Big River. But many of the Zelandanyi caves live near this one, and everyone knows it's the one that's meant when someone says the river. The little tributary down there is called Wood River," Jondalar continued. "Many trees grow near it, and there is more wood in that valley than in most. It's not used by hunters much."
Ayla nodded in tacit understanding. The valley of the feeder stream, flanked on the right by limestone cliffs and on the left by steep hills, was not like most of the open grassy valleys of the main river and its other nearby tributaries. It was dense with trees and vegetation, especially upstream. Unlike more open areas, woodlands were not prized by hunters because hunting was more difficult. Animals were harder to see with trees and brush to hide behind and use for camouflage, and those that migrated in large herds tended to prefer valleys with sizable fields of grass. On the other hand, the valley did provide wood for constructions and implements and for fire. Fruits and nuts were also collected, and several other plants that were gathered for food and other uses, along with smaller animals that fell to snares and traps. In a land of relatively few trees, no one disdained the value of Wood River Valley's contributions. At the northeastern edge of the Ninth Cave's terrace below, which also offered a view of the two river valleys, Ayla saw the obvious remains of a good-sized fire. She hadn't noticed it when she was there. She had been more concerned with following the trail down to the horse's meadow in Wood River Valley.
"Why is there such a large hearth at the edge of the terrace, Jondalar? It can't be for warmth. Is it used for cooking?"
"That's a signal fire," he said, then continued when he noticed her puzzled expression. "A big bale fire can be seen for quite a distance from that spot. We send messages to other caves with the fires, and they pass the messages on with their signal fires."
"What kind of messages?"
"Oh, many kinds. They're used a lot when herds are moving, letting hunters know what's been seen. They're sometimes used to announce events or gathers or some other kind of meeting."
"But how does someone know what the fire means?"
"It's usually arranged in advance, especially when it's the season for certain herds to move and a hunt is planned. And there are certain fire signals that mean someone needs help. Any time that people see a fire burning there, they know to take notice. If they don't know what it means, they'll send a runner to find out.
That's a very clever idea,
she said, then added a thought.
It's something like the clan signs and signals, isn't it? Communicating without words.
I never thought of it that way, but I suppose you're right, he said.
Jandalar went back a different way from the one they had come. He headed toward the river valley along a switchback trail that traversed a zigzag down the steeper incline near the top, then turned right through grass and brush on the more gradual slope. It came out along the edge of the flat lowlands of the right bank of the river and cut directly across Wood River Valley to the Horse's Meadow. On the way back, Ayla felt relaxed, but she didn't have the exhilarating sense of freedom that she'd had on the ride out. Though she liked everyone she had met so far, there was still the big feast, and she was not anticipating meeting the rest of the ninth cave of the Zelandanyi tonight. She wasn't used to so many people all at once. They left Winnie and Racer in the grassy lea and found the place where the soap plant grew, but Jandalar had to point it out. It was one Ayla was not familiar with. She studied it carefully, noted similarities and differences, and made sure she would know it in the future. Then got her pouch of dried ceanothus flowers. Wolf jumped into the river with them, but didn't stay in long after they stopped paying attention to him. After a long swim to soak away the dust and grime of traveling, they crushed the root of the plant and some water in a depression of a flat rock with a rounded stone to release the saponin-rich foam. They rubbed it on themselves and, laughing, on each other, then dove under to rinse off. She gave some ceanothus to Jandalar, then applied some directly to her wet hair. The plant was not as soapy, foaming up only a little, but it smelled sweet and fresh. By the time she rinsed again, the young woman was ready to get out. After drying with the soft skins, they spread them out and sat on them, sunning themselves. Ayla picked up the comb with four long teeth that had been carved out of mammoth ivory, which was a gift from her Mamutoi friend Deji. But when she started combing her hair, Jandalar stopped her.
"Let me do that for you," he said, taking the comb.
He had developed a fondness for combing her hair after she washed it, taking pleasurable delight in feeling the thick mass of wet hair dry into soft, springy tresses, and it made her feel unaccustomedly pampered.
"I like your mother and your sister," Ayla said, sitting with her back to him while he combed. "And Willemar, too."
"They like you, too."
"And Joharan seems like a good leader. Do you know you and your brother have the same frown lines?" she asked.
"I had to like him. He looks so familiar."
"He was smitten by that beautiful smile of yours," Jandalar said, "just as I am."
Ayla was quiet for a time, then showed the direction her thoughts had taken with her next comment.
"You didn't tell me there were so many people in your cave. It's like a whole clan gathering lives here," she said, "and you seem to know them all. I'm not sure if I ever will."
"Don't worry, you will. It won't take you long," he said, trying to work out a particularly irksome tangle. "Oh, sorry. Did I pull too hard?"
"No, it's fine. I'm glad I finally met your Zelandani. She knows medicine. It will be wonderful to have someone to talk with about it."
"She's a powerful woman, Ayla."
"That's obvious. How long has she been Zelandani?"
"Let me think,"
he answered.
"Not long after I left to live with Dalinar, I think. I still thought of her as Zolina then. She was beautiful, voluptuous. I don't think she was ever thin, but she is growing to look more and more like the Great Mother. I think she likes you."
He stopped combing for a moment, paused, then started to laugh.
"What's so funny?" Ayla asked.
"I was listening to you tell her how you found me, and about baby and all. She'll be asking you more questions, you can be sure." I was watching her expression. Every time you answered a question, she probably wanted to ask you three more. You just made her more curious. You do it every time. You are a mystery, even to me. Do you know just how remarkable you are, woman?"
She had turned around, and he was looking at her with loving eyes.
"Give me a little time, and I'll show you how remarkable you can be,"
she answered, a lazy, sensuous smile spreading across her face. Jandalar reached over to kiss her. They heard a laugh, and they both jerked around.
"Oh, did we interrupt anything?"
said a woman. It was the attractive, light-haired, dark-eyed woman who had listened to Falara tell her friends about the newly arrived travelers. Two other women were with her.
"Morona,"
Jandalar said, frowning slightly.
"No, you're not interrupting anything. I'm just surprised to see you."
"Why should you be surprised to see me? Did you think I had left on an unexpected journey?"
Morona said. Jandalar squirmed and glanced at Ayla, who was looking at the women.
"No, of course not. I guess I'm just surprised."
"We were just out taking a walk when we happened to see you there, and I admit, Jandalar, I couldn't resist wanting to make you feel a little uncomfortable. After all, we were promised."
They hadn't been formally promised, but he didn't argue with her. He knew he had certainly given her the impression that they were.
"I didn't know that you would still be living here. I thought you might have mated someone from another cave,"
Jandalar said.
"I did," she said. "It didn't last, so I came back."
She had been eyeing his hard, tanned, naked body in a way that was familiar to him.
"You haven't changed much in 5 years, Jandalar, except for a few nasty scars."
She turned her gaze to Ayla.
"But we really didn't come here to talk to you. We came to meet your friend,"
Morona said.
"She'll be formally introduced to everyone tonight,"
he said, feeling protective of Ayla.
"That's what we heard. But we don't need a formal introduction. We just wanted to greet her and make her welcome."
He could hardly refuse to introduce them.
"Ayla of the Lion Camp of the Mamutoi, this is Morona of the Ninth Cave of the Zelandanyi, and her friends."
He looked more closely.
"Portula? Of the Fifth Cave, is it you?"
Jandalar asked. The woman smiled and blushed with pleasure to be remembered. Morona frowned at her.
"Yes, I'm Portula, but I'm Third Cave now."
She certainly remembered him. He had been chosen for her first rites. But he recalled that she had been one of those young women who had followed him around afterwards, trying to get him alone, even though they were forbidden to associate for at least a year after first rites. Her persistence had spoiled somewhat his memory of a ceremony that usually left him with a warm glow of fondness for the young woman involved.
"I don't think I know your other friend, Morona,"
Jandalar said. She seemed to be a little younger than the other two.
"I'm Lareva, Portula's sister," the young woman said. "We all became acquainted when I was mated to a man from the Fifth Cave," Morona said. "They came to visit me."
She turned to Ayla.
"Greetings, Ayla of the Mamutoi."
Ayla stood up to return the greetings. Although it normally wouldn't have bothered her, she found herself feeling slightly disconcerted to be greeting unfamiliar women with no clothes on, and wrapped her drying skin around her, tucking it in at the waist, and put her amulet back around her neck.
"Greetings, Morona of the Ninth Cave of the Zelandanyi,"
Ayla said, her slightly rolled R's and peculiar throaty accent marking her immediately as a stranger.
"Greetings, Portula of the Fifth Cave, and greetings to her sister Lareva," she continued.
The younger woman tittered at Ayla's funny way of talking, and then tried to hide it, and Jandalar thought he noticed a trace of a smirk on Morona's face. His brow wrinkled in a frown.
"I wanted to do more than greet you, Ayla," Morona said. "I don't know if Jandalar ever mentioned it, but as you know by now, we were promised before he decided to leave on this great journey he suddenly had to make. As I'm sure you must know, I wasn't very pleased about it."
Jandalar was trying to think of something to say to ward off what he felt sure was coming, Morona letting Ayla know that she was very unhappy by giving her an earful of his faults. But she surprised him.
"But that was in the past," Morona said. "To be honest, I haven't thought about him in years until you arrived today. Other people may not have forgotten, however, and some of them like to talk. I wanted to give them something else to talk about, to show them that I can greet you appropriately."
She motioned toward her friends to include them.
We were going to go to my room to get ready for your welcome feast tonight, and we thought you might like to join us, Ayla. My cousin Wailopa is there already. You remember Wailopa, don't you, Jandalar? I thought it would give you a chance to get acquainted with some women before all the formal meetings tonight.
Ayla noticed some tension, particularly between Jandalar and Morona, but under the circumstances that wouldn't be unusual. Jandalar had mentioned Morona and that they had been almost promised before he left, and Ayla could imagine how she would feel in the woman's place. But Morona had been straightforward about it, and Ayla did want to get to know some of the women better. She missed women friends. She had known so few women her own age when she was growing up.
Uba, Issa's true daughter, had been like a sister to her, but Uba was much younger. And while Ayla had grown to care for all the women of Brun's clan, there were differences. No matter how hard she tried to be a good clan woman, something she could not change. It wasn't until she went to live with the Mamutoi and met Deji that she came to appreciate the fun of having someone her own age to talk to. She missed Deji, and Tholi of the Sharamadoi, too, who had quickly become a friend that Ayla would always remember.
"Thank you, Morona. I would like to join you. This is all I have to wear," she said, quickly putting on her simple travel-stained outfit. "But Marthona and Folara are going to help me make some clothes. I'd like to see what you wear."
"Perhaps we can give you a few things as a welcoming gift," Morona said.
"Would you take this drying skin back with you, Jandalar?"
Ayla said. "Of course," he said.
He held her close for a heartbeat and brushed her cheek with his. Then she left with the three women.
As Jandalar watched them go, his troubled frown deepened. Though he hadn't formally asked Morona to be his mate, he had led her to believe they would be joined at the matrimonial of the upcoming summer meeting before he left, and she had been making plans. Instead, he left with his brother on a journey and just hadn't shown up. It must have been difficult for her. It wasn't that he had loved her. There was no doubt she was beautiful. Most men considered her to be the most beautiful and desirable woman at the summer meetings. And though he didn't entirely agree, she certainly had her ways when it came to sharing Dani's gift of pleasure. She just wasn't the one he desired most. But people said they were perfect for each other. They looked so good together, and everyone had expected them to tie the knot. He more or less did, too. He knew he wanted to share a hearth with a woman and her children some day, and since he couldn't have Zolina, the one woman he wanted, it might as well be Morona. He had not really admitted it to himself, but he had felt relieved when he decided to go with Thonolin on a journey. At the time, it seemed the easiest way to extricate himself from his involvement with her. He had been sure she would find someone else while he was gone. She said she had, but it hadn't lasted. He had expected to find her with a hearth full of children. She didn't say anything about children at all. It was surprising. He had no idea he would find her unmated when he returned. She was still a beautiful woman, but she did have a temper and a vicious streak. She could be very spiteful and vindictive. Jandalar's forehead knotted with concern as he watched Ayla and the three women walking toward the ninth cave.
Chapter 6
Wolf saw Ayla walking along the path through the horse meadow with the three women and raced toward her. Lareva squealed at the sight of the large carnivore. Portula gasped and looked around in panic for a place to run. Morona blanched in fear. Ayla glanced at the women as soon as she saw the wolf, and noting their reactions, quickly signaled him to stay.
"Stop, wolf!"
she voiced aloud, more for the benefit of the women than to halt the animal, although it did reinforce her signal. Wolf stopped in his tracks and watched Ayla, alert for a sign that he could approach her.
"Would you like to meet Wolf?" she said.
Then, seeing that the women still showed fear, she added,
"He won't hurt you."
"Why would I want to meet an animal?" Morona said.
The tone of her voice made Ayla look more closely at the light-haired woman. She noted fear, but, surprisingly, an inflection of disgust and even anger. Ayla could understand the fear, but the rest of Morona's reaction seemed inappropriate. It was certainly not the response she was used to seeing the animal evoke. The other two women looked at Morona, then seemed to follow her lead, showing no indication that they wanted to get close to the wolf. Wolf's stance had become more wary, Ayla saw. He must sense something, too, she thought.
"Wolf, go find Jandalar," she said, giving him a signal to go.
He stayed a moment longer, watching her, then bounded away as she turned to walk up the path toward the enormous stone shelter of the ninth cave with the three women. They passed by several people on the path, and each one showed an immediate reaction to seeing her with the women. Some cast speculative glances or bemused smiles. Some seemed surprised, even startled. Only young children seemed to pay no attention to them. Ayla could not help but notice, and it put her a bit on edge. She studied Morona and the other women, though not obviously, using the techniques of women of the clan. No one could be more inconspicuous than clan women. They could quietly fade into the background and seem to disappear, and they gave the impression that they were not aware of anything around them. But that was misleading. From the time they were very young, girls were taught never to stare or even look directly at a man, to be unobtrusive, and yet they were expected to know when one needed or wanted her attention. As a consequence, clan women learned to focus carefully and precisely, and with a glance absorb significant information from posture, movement, and expression very quickly, and they missed little. Ayla was as adept as any of them, though she wasn't as aware of this legacy of her years with the clan as she was of her ability to read body language. Her observations of the women put her on guard and made her think again about Morona's motives, but she didn't want to make any assumptions. Once they were under the stone ledge, they headed in a different direction from the one she had gone before and entered a large dwelling more toward the middle of the space. Morona led them in, and they were greeted by another woman who seemed to be waiting for them.
"Ayla, this is my cousin Wailopa," Morona said, on their way through the main room and into a side sleeping room. "Wailopa, this is Ayla."
"Greetings," Wailopa said.
After the rather formal introductions Ayla had had to all of Jandalar's close kin, this offhand presentation to Morona's cousin, with no welcome, though it was her first time in this dwelling, struck Ayla as odd. It was not consistent with the behavior she had already come to expect from the Zelandanyi.
"Greetings, Wailopa," Ayla said. "This dwelling, is it yours?"
Wailopa was surprised at Ayla's unusual enunciation and was so unused to hearing any language other than her own, she had some trouble understanding the stranger.
"No," Morona interjected. "This is the home of my brother and his mate and their three children. Wailopa and I live here with them. We share this room."
Ayla glanced quickly around at the space set off by panels, similar to the way Marthona's dwelling was divided.
"We were going to fix our hair and faces for the celebration tonight," Portula said.
She glanced at Morona with an ingratiating smile, which became a smirk when she looked back at Ayla.
"We thought you might like to get ready with us." "Thank you for asking me. I would like to see what you do," Ayla said. "I don't know Zelandanyi ways. My friend Diji used to fix my hair sometimes, but she is Mamutoi and lives very far away. I know I will never see her again, and I miss her. It's nice to have women friends."
Portula was surprised and touched by the newcomer's honest and friendly response, her smirk warmed to a real smile.
"Since it's a feast to welcome you," Morona said, "we thought we'd give you something to wear, too. I asked my cousin to gather some clothes for you to try on, Ayla."
Morona looked at clothing that had been placed around.
"You found a good selection, Wailopa."
Lareva giggled. Portula looked away. Ayla noticed several outfits spread out on the bed and floor, primarily leggings and long-sleeved shirts or tunics. Then she looked at the clothing the four women were wearing. Wailopa, who seemed older than Morona, was wearing an outfit similar to the ones laid out, worn quite loose, Ayla noticed. Lareva, who was rather young, had on a short, sleeveless leather tunic, belted around the hips, cut somewhat differently from the one spread out. Portula, who was fairly plump, wore a full skirt made of some kind of fibrous material and a loose-fitting top with a long fringe that hung over the skirt. Morona, who was thin but shapely, had on a very short sleeveless top, open in front, profusely decorated with beads and feathers, with a reddish fringe around the bottom that stopped just below her waist, and a loincloth skirt, similar to the kind Ayla had worn on hot days on her journey. Jandalar had shown her how to take a rectangular strip of soft leather, pull it up between her legs, and tie it on with a thong around her waist. Letting the long ends hang down both front and back, and pulling them together at the sides, made the loincloth resemble a short skirt. Morona's, she noticed, was fringed on both front and back ends. She had left an open space on both sides, showing a long, bare, shapely leg, and tied the thong low, barely over her hips, causing the fringe in front and back to sway when she walked. Ayla thought Morona's clothes, the very short top that did not meet in front and could never be closed, and the skimpy loincloth skirt, looked small for her, as though they had been made for a child, not a woman. Yet she was certain that the light-haired woman chose her clothing purposefully and with great care. "Go ahead, pick something out," Morona said, "and then we'll fix your hair. We want this to be a special night for you."
"All these things look so big and heavy," Ayla said. "Won't they be too warm?"
"It cools off at night," Wylopa said, "and these clothes are supposed to be worn loose, like this." She lifted her arms and showed the loose, blousy fit.
"Here, try this on," Morona said, picking up a tunic. "We'll show you how it's supposed to be worn."
Ayla removed her own tunic, then her amulet bag from around her neck and put it on a shelf, and let the women slip the other tunic over her head. Even though she was taller than any of the four women, it hung down to her knees, and the long sleeves fell below her fingertips.
"This is too big," Ayla said.
She didn't see Lareva, but she thought she heard a muffled sound behind her.
"No, it's not," Wylopa said, smiling broadly. "You just need a belt, and you're supposed to roll up the sleeves, like I did, see? Portula, bring that belt so I can show her."
The plump woman brought a belt, but she wasn't smiling any more, unlike Morona and her cousin, who smiled excessively. Morona took the belt and wrapped it around Ayla.
"You tie it low, like this, around your hips, and let it blouse out, and then the fringe hangs down. See?"
Ayla still felt there was far too much material.
"No, I don't think this one fits right. It really is too big. And look at these leggings," she said, taking the pair that was beside the tunic and holding them in front of herself. "The waist comes up much too high."
She pulled the tunic off over her head.
"You're right," Morona said. "Try on another one."
They picked out another outfit, slightly smaller and very intricately decorated with ivory beads and shells.
"This is very beautiful," Ayla said,
looking down at the front of the tunic.
"Almost too beautiful."
Lareva snorted strangely, and Ayla turned to look at her, but she was facing away.
"But it's really very heavy and still too big," Ayla continued, taking off the second tunic.
"I suppose you might think it's too big if you're not used to Zelandanyi clothes," Morona said, frowning.
Then she brightened with a self-satisfied smile.
"But perhaps you are right. Wait here. I think I know something that would be just perfect, and it was just made."
She left the sleeping room and went into another part of the dwelling. After a while, she returned with another outfit. This one was much smaller and lighter in weight. Ayla tried it on. The tight leggings came halfway down her calf, but fit correctly at the waist, where the front overlapped and tied with a sturdy, flexible thong. The top was a sleeveless tunic with a deep V cut down the front, laced together with thin leather thongs. It was a little small, and Ayla could not lace it together tightly, but with the thongs loosened, it wasn't bad. Unlike the others, it was a simple, undecorated outfit, made of a soft leather that felt nice against her skin.
"This is very comfortable," Ayla said.
"And I have just the thing to set it off,"
Morona said, showing her a belt woven out of various colored fibers into an intricate pattern.
"This is beautifully made and very interesting,"
Ayla said, as Morona tied it low around her waist. She felt satisfied with the outfit.
"This one will do," she said. "I thank you for your gift."
She put on her amulet and folded her other clothes. Lareva choked and coughed.
"I need some water,"
she said, and dashed from the room.
"Now you must let me fix your hair," Wailopa said, still smiling broadly.
"I promise to do your face after I do Portula's,"
Morona said.
"And you said you'd fix my hair, Wailopa,"
Portula said.
"You promised to do me, too,"
Lareva said from the entrance to the room.
"If you are over your coughing spell,"
Morona said, giving the young woman a hard look. While Wailopa combed and fussed with her hair, Ayla watched with interest as Morona decorated the faces of the other two women. She used solidified fats, mixed with finely powdered red and yellow ochres, to add color to mouths, cheeks, and forehead, and mixed with black charcoal to emphasize the eyes. Then she used more intense shades of the same colors to add carefully drawn designs of dots, curved lines, and various other shapes to their faces in a way that reminded Ayla of the tattoo she had seen on some people.
"Let me do your face now, Ayla," Morona said. "I think Wailopa is done with your hair."
"Oh, yes," Wailopa said. "I'm finished. Let Morona do your face."
While the face decorations of the women were interesting, Ayla felt uncomfortable with the idea. In Marthona's dwelling, there was a subtle use of color and design that was very pleasing, but Ayla wasn't sure she liked the way the women looked. It seemed too much somehow.
"No, I don't think so," Ayla said.
"But you have to,"
Lareva said, looking dismayed.
"Everyone does it," Morona said. "You would be the only one without it."
"Yes, go on. Let Morona do it. It's what all the women do,"
Wailopa said.
"You really should,"
Lareva urged. "Everyone always wants Morona to paint her face. You're lucky she's willing." They were pressing her so hard, it made Ayla want to resist. Marthona had not said anything to her about having to get her face painted. She wanted to take the time to find her way and not be pushed into customs she was not familiar with.
"No, not this time. Perhaps later," Ayla said.
"Oh, go ahead and do it. Don't spoil everything,"
Lareva said.
"No, I don't want to have my face painted,"
Ayla said, with such firm resolve they finally stopped pressing her. She watched them dress each other's hair in intricate plaits and coils, placing decorated combs and pins attractively. Finally, they added facial ornaments. Ayla hadn't really noticed the holes at strategic locations in their faces until they put earrings into their earlobes and plug-like ornaments into their noses, cheeks, and under the lower lips. But she saw that some of the painted decorations now accentuated the ornaments that had been added.
"Don't you have any piercings?"
Lareva asked.
"You'll just have to get some. Too bad we can't do them now."
Ayla wasn't sure if she wanted to be pierced, except perhaps in the earlobes, so she could wear the earrings she had brought with her all the way from the summer meeting of the mammoth hunters. She watched the women add beads and pendants around their necks and bracelets on their arms. She noticed that the women glanced from time to time at something behind a dividing panel. Finally, a little bored with all the combing and decorating, she got up and wandered over to see what they were looking at. She heard Lareva gasp when she saw the piece of blackened, shiny wood similar to the reflector in Marthona's dwelling, and looked at herself. Ayla was not happy with the reflection she saw. Her hair had been dressed into braids and coils, but they seemed to be in odd, unattractive placements, not in the pleasing, symmetrical order of the other women. She saw Wailopa and Morona looking at each other, then look away. When she tried to catch the eye of one of the women, they avoided her. Something strange was going on, and she didn't think she liked it. She certainly did not like what had been done to her hair.
"I think I'll wear my hair loose," Ayla said, as she began to take out the combs, pins, and bindings. Jandalar likes it that way.
When she had removed all the paraphernalia, she picked up the comb and pulled it through her long, thick, dark blonde hair, springy with a fresh, washed, natural wave. She adjusted her amulet around her neck. She never liked to be without it, though she often wore it under her clothes. Then looked at herself in the reflector. Maybe some day she'd learn to fix her own hair, but for now she liked it much better the way it fell naturally. She glanced at Wailopa and wondered why the woman hadn't seen how peculiar her hair had looked. Ayla noticed her leather amulet bag in the reflector and tried to see it the way someone else might. It was lumpy with the objects it contained, and the color was much darker from sweat and wear than it had been. The small decorated bag had originally been intended as a sewing kit. Now only dark quill shafts remained of what had once been white feathers decorating the rounded bottom edge. But the ivory beaded design was still intact and added an interesting look with the simple leather tunic. She decided to let it show. She remembered that it was her friend Deji who had persuaded her to use it as her amulet when she saw the plain and grimy pouch Ayla had worn before. Now this one was old and worn. She thought she ought to make a new one soon to replace it, but she would not throw this one away. It held too many memories. She could hear activity outside and was getting very tired of watching the women adding insignificant little finishing touches to each other's face or hair that had no visible effect that she could discern. Finally, there was a scratch on the rawhide panel beside the opening of the living structure.
"Everyone's waiting for Ayla," a voice called.
It sounded like Falara.
"Tell them she'll be out soon," Morona answered.
"Are you sure you won't let me paint your face a little, Ayla? After all, it is a celebration for you."
"No, I really don't want to."
"Well, since they're waiting for you, maybe you should go ahead. We'll be along in a while," Morona said. "We still have to change."
"I think I will,"
Ayla said, glad to have an excuse to leave. They had been inside for a long time, it seemed to her.
"Thank you for your gifts," she remembered to say. "This is really a very comfortable outfit."
She picked up her worn tunic and short pants and went out. She saw no one under the overhanging shelter. Falara had gone ahead without waiting for her. Ayla quickly veered toward Marthona's dwelling and left her old clothing inside the entrance. Then she walked rapidly toward the crowd of people she saw outside, beyond the shadow of the high stone shelf that protected the structures nestled beneath it. As she came out into the light of the late afternoon sun, a few people nearby noticed her and stopped talking to gape. Then a few more noticed her and stared, jostling their neighbors to look too. Ayla slowed down and then stopped, looking back at the people who were looking at her. Soon, all the talking stopped. Suddenly, into the stillness, someone let out a stifled guffaw. Then another person laughed, and another. Soon, everyone was laughing. Why were they laughing? Were they laughing at her? Was something wrong? Her face reddened with embarrassment. Had she committed some terrible blunder? She looked around, wanting to run away, but not knowing which way to turn. She saw Jandalar striding toward her, his face an angry scowl. Marthona was hurrying towards her, too, from another direction.
"Jandalar," Ayla called out as he approached, "why is everyone laughing at me? What's wrong? What have I done?"
She was speaking in Mamutoi and didn't realize it.
"You're wearing a boy's winter underwear. Your belt is one that is worn by a young man during his puberty initiation to let people know he is ready for his Danyi woman,"
Jandalar said in the same language she had spoken. He was furious that Ayla had been made the butt of such a cruel joke on her first day with his people.
"Where did you get those clothes?" Marthona asked as she approached.
"Morona,"
Jandalar answered for her.
"When we were at the river, she came and told Ayla that she wanted to help her dress for the celebration tonight. I should have guessed she had some vicious plan in mind to get back at me."
They all turned around and looked back under the abris toward the dwelling of Morona's brother. Standing just inside the shadows of the overhang were the four women. They were holding their sides, leaning against each other, laughing so hard at the woman they had tricked into wearing completely inappropriate boys' clothing that tears were streaming down their faces, smearing their careful makeup with red and black streaks. Ayla realized they were taking great pleasure in her discomfort and embarrassment. As she watched the women, she felt a flush of anger rise within her. This was the gift they wanted to give her? To welcome her? They wanted people to laugh at her like this? She understood then that everything they had laid out for her was inappropriate for a woman. It was obvious to her now that it all had been men's clothing. But it wasn't only the clothes, she realized. Was that why they had made her hair look so peculiar? So people would laugh at her? And had they planned to paint her face to make her look laughable, too? Ayla had always rejoiced in laughter. When she lived with the clan, she was the only one who laughed with pleasure until her son was born. When people of the clan made a grimace that resembled a smile, it was not a sign of happiness. It was an expression of nervousness or fearfulness, or it signaled a threat of possible aggression. Her son was the only baby who smiled and laughed as she did, and though it made them uneasy, she had loved Dirk's happy giggles. When she had lived in the valley, she had laughed with delight at the antics of Winnie and Baby when they were young. Jondalar's ready smile and rare, uninhibited laughter had made her know she had met her own kind in him, had made her love him more. And it had been Talut's welcoming smile and hearty bellow that encouraged her to visit the lion camp the first time they met. She had met many people in their travels and had laughed with them many times, but she had never been laughed at before. She had never learned that laughter could be used to hurt. This was the first time laughter had caused her pain and not joy. Marthona, too, was not happy with the nasty trick that had been played on the visitor, the guest of the ninth cave of the Zelindanyi, whom her son had brought home to mate with him and become one of them. "Come with me, Ayla," Marthona said. "Let me get you something more appropriate. I'm sure we can find something of mine that you can wear." "Or something of mine," Flara said. She had seen the whole incident and had come to help. Ayla started to go with them, then stopped. "No," she said. Those women had given her the wrong clothes as gifts of welcome, because they wanted to make her look outlandish, different, to show she didn't belong. Well, she had thanked them for their gifts, and she was going to wear them. It was not the first time she had been the object of stares. She had always been the odd one, the ugly one, the strange one among the people of the clan. They had never laughed at her. They didn't know how to laugh like that. But they had all stared at her when she arrived at the clan gathering. If she had been able to stand being the only one who was different, who did not belong, the only one who was not clan at the entire clan gathering, she could certainly stand up to the Zelindanyi. At least they looked the same. Ayla straightened her back, clamped her jaw shut, jutted out her chin and glared at the laughing throng. "Thank you, Marthona, and you too, Folara. But this outfit will do just fine. It was given to me as a gift of welcome. I would not be so discourteous as to cast it aside." She glanced behind her and noticed that Marona and the others were gone. They had returned to Marona's room. Ayla turned back to face the large gathering of people who had assembled and started walking toward them. Marthona and Falara looked at Jondalar, stunned, when she passed by, but he could only shrug and shake his head. Ayla caught a familiar movement out of the corner of her eye as she proceeded. Wolf had appeared at the head of the path and was running toward her. When he reached her, she patted herself and he jumped up and put his paws on the front of her shoulders, then licked her throat and took it gently in his jaws. There was an audible commotion from the crowd. Ayla signaled him down, then indicated that he should follow her, closely, the way she had taught him at the Mamutoi summer meeting. As Ayla moved through the group, there was something about the way she walked, something about her determination, something about her defiant look in the face of those who laughed, and something about Wolf walking at her side that silenced them. Soon No one felt like laughing anymore. She walked into the midst of a group of people whom she had met before. Willemar, Joharan, and Zelindani greeted her. She turned around to find Jondalar right behind her, followed by Marthona and Fulara.
"I have not yet met some of the people here. Would you introduce me, Jondalar?"
Ayla said. Joharan stepped forward instead.
"Ayla of the Mamutoi, member of the Lion Camp, daughter of the Mammoth Hearth, chosen by the spirit of the cave lion and protected by the spirit of the cave bear, and friend of horses and a wolf, this is my mate, Proliva of the ninth cave of the Zelindanyi, daughter of—"
Willemar grinned as formal introductions were made to close kin and friends, but his expression was in no way derisive. Marthona, more and more amazed, observed with greater interest the young woman her son had brought home with him. She caught Zelindani's eye, and a knowing glance passed between them. They would discuss this later. Many people looked at her more than once, especially men, who began to notice how well the garments and belt fit the person wearing them, in spite of what they meant to them. She had been traveling for the past year, walking or riding a horse, and her muscles were firm. The close-fitting boy's winter undergarment emphasized her lean, muscular, well-formed body. Since she hadn't been able to lace the thongs together in front across her firm but rather ample breasts, the opening exposed her cleavage. Somehow more enticing than the more familiar naked breasts they often saw. The leggings showed off her long, shapely legs and rounded buttocks, and the cinched belt, in spite of what its design symbolized, accented her waist, only slightly thickened with the early stages of pregnancy. On Ayla, the outfit took on new meaning. Although many women did wear facial ornaments and paint, her lack of them only served to highlight her natural beauty. Her long hair, tumbling loosely in the disarray of natural waves and ringlets that caught the last rays of the setting sun, was an appealing and sensuous contrast to the well-groomed coiffures of the other women. She seemed young and reminded adult men of their own youth and their first awakening to the Great Earth Mother's gift of pleasure. It made them wish they were young again, and that Ayla was their Danyi woman. The outlandishness of Ayla's clothing was quickly forgotten, accepted as somehow appropriate for the beautiful stranger with the low-pitched voice and exotic accent. It was certainly no more strange than her control over horses and wolf. Jondalar noticed people watching Ayla and heard her name mentioned in the undercurrent of conversation. He overheard a man say, "That's a remarkably beautiful woman Jondalar has brought home with him."
"You'd expect him to bring a beautiful woman," a woman's voice replied. "But she has courage, too, and a strong will. I'd like to get to know her better."
The comments made Jondalar look at Ayla again, and suddenly he saw the way she looked. Not the incongruity of the costume. Few women could claim such an exceptional shape, especially women of her age who usually had had a child or two to slacken youthful muscle tone. Few would choose to wear such a close-fitting outfit, even if it had been appropriate. Most would prefer looser, more concealing, and for them, more comfortable clothes. And he did love her hair worn loose like that. "She's a beautiful woman," he thought, "and courageous." He relaxed and smiled, remembering their afternoon ride and the stop on the high field, thinking how lucky he was. Morona and her three confederates had returned, still laughing, to her room to repair the damage to their face paint. They had planned to make their appearance later, dressed in their best and most suitable clothing, expecting to make a grand entrance. Morona had exchanged the loincloth skirt.